You count so big.
Late afternoon. Welcome to the Joint Interim Committee on Health Insurance Transition. And I would like to open an organizational meeting to adopt the committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move we adopt the proposed committee rules in front of us dated 12/10/14.
Representative Greenlick has a move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 12/10/14. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to make sure I understand the co-chair, the rules here. Is every place it says chair in the rules, it's actually co-co-chairs, right?
Thank you for clarifying that.
It's the two of you. It says the chair shall set the agenda. It's the co-chair shall set the agenda, correctly?
Correct. I'm so glad that we have you on this committee.
As long as it's not about Cocoa Puffs.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Rules are adopted. Okay. I will now we'll open an informational meeting. And I first want to just say that we have, with our health care transformation in Oregon, we have been extremely successful. I mean, having 95% of Oregonians having health insurance is such a feather in our cap, so to speak. I mean, compared to what we had before we started with the health care transformation. But as you know, we have had problems with the IT system. We don't have an IT system, or at least the IT system that we were developing was never really fully functional. So now we are using the federal IT system. But it is clear, even though, well, it's clear now with all these things that have happened, that the governor and the presiding officers of the House and of the Senate want to remove the remaining state functions back into the state. And so we need to look at some key functions, and the key functions of a state-based exchange no longer includes development and management of a large technology project. That is off the table. And the current organizational structure doesn't support the exchange's ongoing role in the commercial health insurance market. So these remaining state functions that we have and the expertise in those functions, we feel, or at least the leadership felt, would work best in the Department of Business and Consumer Services. So there is a current draft, LC 1203, that you will that we will have a legislative council go through after some opening comments. But the what we want to look at is always a commitment to reform for improved health outcomes. And we, the leadership again felt that the state should retain control of the individual and small group markets so that we can ensure and continue delivery in the system reform. We also have to have financial stability. Any structure has to be financially self-sustaining. We need to have accountability, strong public oversight, and accountability has to be built in moving forward. And we need to know what we will be doing in the future regarding this health exchange, and we need to figure out how best the functions can be achieved through this transition process, and we have to limit risk. We should learn from the past, which I know that we have, to limit risk and scope, and there needs to be, continue to be a need to be focused and disciplined. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We passed the notion of our health exchange with a very large majority in both houses, and it was because we were really committed to doing things the Oregon way. It turned out we didn't exactly do it the Oregon way as we went in the past. I would pick a different state to blame on this. But the idea that we wanted to do it the Oregon way was really important to us, and it continues to be important to us. While we've moved to a federal technology going forward, we believe that we really need to have a state-based market, at least I believe, and I think the leadership of the House and the Senate believe that we need to have a state-based market, and that's what the purpose of this this committee and this process is, to ask how can we transition from where we are now to a new version of a state-based market and bring it in-house, so to speak, in a way that makes some sense. So we're going to hear testimony today about where we are at the moment and where we need to go. And if we move the Cover Oregon into DCBS, how it might be processed in there, and to get some comments from key actors in the state in some discussion. We plan our next meeting in January, where we'll have a much broader public discussion at that point, and we'll be open for a much greater group of public commenters. And we should have room for that. But today, we're going to review where we are. We're going to think about where we're going, and we're going to get some comments from some key actors. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. I would like each of the committee members to introduce themselves. If you want to make a sentence or two comment, that is fine. Representative Davis.
Thank you. I'm Representative John Davis from House District 26, representing Wilsonville, Sherwood, King City, Hillsboro, Beaverton, Tigard, Alloa, half of Bull Mountain, and unincorporated Washington and Clackamas County. It is my great pleasure to be here with all of you today.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I'm Representative Nancy Nathanson. My district is generally North Eugene and part of downtown Eugene.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi, I'm Representative Kenny Geyer from House District 46, which is parts of southeast and northeast Portland.
Bill. I'm Bill Kenner, state representative, represents Charbonneau, Canby, and significant portions of mostly rural Clackamas County.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you. Elizabeth Steiner-Hayward, state senator from District 17, which is most of northwest Portland, a chunk of unincorporated Multnomah in Washington County, and about a third of Beaverton. And in my spare time, I'm a family physician.
And Senator Girod just stepped out. If he comes back, we'll have him introduce himself. Senator Bates.
Hi, I'm Al Bates. I'm a state senator from Southern Oregon, and according to some of my constituents who call from Weed and Colt and a few other places, obviously parts of Northern California, too, which is kind of never figured out why they call me for help in California issues, but we do the best we can for them. Okay?
I'm Senator Brian Boquist, District 12, Western Willamette Valley, and I also served on the Legislative Oversight Committee for the implementation of Cover Oregon.
And Senator Girod, do you want to just briefly introduce yourself?
Or did Peter just remove you?
The man who needs no introduction is now back.
Oh, thank you. Fred Girod, Senate District 9, rural Clackamas, Marion, and Linn counties.
Great.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
She did.
Oh, she did.
All right. We now will go ahead and have an overview of the state-based exchange functions as it exists today. And Aaron Patnaud, the Executive Director of Cover Oregon, will be speaking.
Co-Chair Montez Anderson, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for having me this afternoon. I'm happy to be here and participating in this very important conversation to our state. I'll be running through a number of brief slides. I'll be happy to take any of your questions as we go through this presentation, and we'll be here for the remainder of the meeting as well. So as Senator Mona Zanderson indicated, I will be providing a brief overview of the background of Oregon's health insurance marketplace. For many of you who participate in the Health and Human Services Committees on both the House and Senate side, this will be review for some of you. But for folks who are new to the conversation, I thought it was a great starting point for all of us to be grounded in where we started as a state. So the overall health care reform goal for the state of Oregon, as many of you know, has three key important points: improve the patient experience, improve the health of the population, and reduce the per capita cost of health care by 2017. And many folks refer to this as the triple aim of health care. And the tactics to achieve that goal, Oregon is pursuing two main tactics to get there. First, continued development and implementation of the insurance marketplace, the conversation that we're having today. And the second is continued development and implementation of the coordinated care model, which is outside of this conversation. So some of the key dates pertaining to the conversation. In March of 2010, the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, into federal law. In June of 2011, Senate Bill 99 was signed, creating Oregon's Health Insurance Exchange as a state-based exchange and operating as a public corporation. In March 2012, the legislature approved the business plan for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation. In October 2012, the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation adopted the name Cover Oregon. In October 2013 was the first instance of open enrollment beginning. October 1st of 2014 was the date that the insurance marketplace was to be up and running and active. And I think, as all of you know, the history of the marketplace is not included on this slide, but I think should be very familiar to all of you. There has been a transition from that initial pathway that the state set out on as a state-based marketplace, and we are currently referred to as a supported state-based marketplace, although supported state-based marketplaces are found nowhere in statute. So the federal government actually still recognizes us as a state-based marketplace with an asterisk, that we are using healthcare.gov as a vended technology to sell our insurance products to private consumers in the state. So how do we get to that point? So the Technology Options Work Group was convened in March of 2014 to study the problem associated with the exchange and potential solutions. So and prior to my role at Cover Oregon, when I was working in the private sector on the insurance side, I actually participated in this work group on behalf of one of the carriers that's still participating in the market today. So I was actively involved in these conversations about the transition. There were some assumptions that we took into that conversation. So we knew that folks needed to enroll, renew, and change circumstances for individuals, and they needed to be able to do this online, much like the original vision of the marketplace. And this needed to be done within Cover Oregon's current budget, in addition to limiting the risk by or before November 15th of 2014. November 15th of 2014 represents the first day of the 2015 open enrollment period, which we're actively in right now. So it was very important that any transition that the Technology Options Work Group came up with was complete by that point in time, so Oregonians could successfully enroll in 2015 coverage. Based on recommendations on risk schedule and cost of potential solutions. So again, we wanted to limit the risk to the state, acknowledge the fact that there was a sizable investment made, and utilize as much as the state could of what had been developed as the marketplace in the future operations of the marketplace. The Board of Directors for Cover Oregon took action on April 25th of 2014. To make the transition of the federal to federal technology for qualified health plan, QHP, eligibility and enrollment. So this is specific to the private marketplace. Any place you see QHP refers to private insurance. So what are the requirements of a state-based marketplace? So state-based marketplaces must be a government agency or a nonprofit entity established by the state. CMS must approve an exchange blueprint showing readiness to operate a state-based marketplace. And this is actually a document that needs to be refreshed over time as substantive changes are made to the functions of the marketplace. We went through a refresh of that blueprint as we approached November 15th, 2014. And as is stated there, CMS must approve any significant changes in advance of the actual function of those changes being implemented. State-based marketplaces must submit an annual report to CMS capturing all required activity, performance, and financial data. Cover Oregon continues to provide CMS and SSIO with that information, so we actively participate in those conversations. Excuse me. State-based marketplaces must also engage in independent external audits on both the financial and programmatic side. We are currently in our 2014 preliminary financial audit with our external auditing agency. We will have our actual audit in February of 2015. Our programmatic audit will take place later in the spring of 2015. And as I mentioned earlier, there's no specific definition of supported state-based marketplace built into statute anywhere. So as we participate in conversations with the federal government, they refer to Oregon as a state-based marketplace, along with the 15 other state-based marketplaces across the country. So a lot of folks, as I've gone and been making the rounds in preparation for this conversation, I've asked, well, what is it exactly that you've been doing, and what is it that you need to do or the state needs to do moving forward in order to have this marketplace? So what I asked our team at Cover Oregon to do was make a simple table and provide some check marks with some of the key functionality to give folks a perspective of, in 2014, what the marketplace actually conducted, and for 2015 open enrollment, what Cover Oregon, the marketplace, is actually conducting today, and what actually lives with the Federally Facilitated Marketplace, or FFM, and what the carriers have actually adopted as their functionality as we go through this 2015 open enrollment period. I do have a summary slide at the end of this, so I'd be happy to walk through each one of these. I think in the interest of time, I'll just talk at the high level and then go to the summary slide if that's okay, but I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards about any of these. So eligibility determinations and enrollment. This is that big technology piece that the technology advisory group made the recommendation to move to healthcare.gov. So when somebody applies and or goes to the website and actually puts their demographic information in, and it's determined that they're eligible for private insurance and then actually enrolling in that plan, that's what this first line at the top of the page represents. Plan management, in large part, is all the activity that the marketplace has in relation to operations with the carriers. So working with carriers to enter into a contract, determining what the metrics of that contract are, how the marketplace operates, working with carriers on a day-to-day basis during the open enrollment period to ensure that their needs are being met, ultimately providing carrier support. The call center you'll see in 2015 has a check mark under both supported state-based marketplace and federally facilitated marketplace. This is a shared responsibility. So the federal marketplace call center is open 24 hours, 7 days a week. Cover Oregon also is required to provide a call center function to provide local assistance to those Oregonians who are interested in finding local options to get help in enrollment. So, unfortunately, Cover Oregon cannot see into the eligibility and enrollment system. So any questions regarding specific functionality or application problems that individuals or families are having with the process, we connect directly to healthcare.gov to have those questions resolved. Operations, this is just the day-to-day operations of the marketplace, so ensuring that any issues that come up for consumers or those eligible to pursue private insurance are being addressed in the proper way. And the shop, and you'll see shop a number of places. It's included in the legislative concept, excuse me. It refers to the small business health options plan. Shop is a term that every state uses in relation to the small group marketplace, if you will. So in the supported state-based marketplace model, it still is a responsibility of the state to provide that option for small employers. Public education and outreach, this is a very active portion of our responsibility today, given the fact that we're right smack dab in the middle of the open enrollment period. These are many of the functions that we provide for public education and outreach as Cover Oregon. We do supplement some healthcare.gov advertising that's taking place during this open enrollment period, but in large part, Cover Oregon is responsible for connecting with consumers in this state to ensure that they know what they need to do in order to gain coverage for 2015. Excuse me. There are also some responsibility for agents, but you'll note that this slide potentially represents the biggest shift of check marks, if you will. In 2014, Cover Oregon served as the agency of record, if you will. So all insurance agents or brokers that sold plans in 2014, in essence, were affiliated with Cover Oregon, the insurance brokerage, if you will. Cover Oregon then would take commission payments from the insurance carriers and pass them through to the brokers for those where the funds were due for the work that the brokers had done. That changes for this 2015 open enrollment period, and brokers and agents are working directly with the carriers whose products they will sell through healthcare.gov. So Cover Oregon is removed from that process for 2015 open enrollment.
But just a clarification, and I think you've told me this before, that the problems with some brokers being paid now is Cover Oregon's problem. Now you're working on taking care of that, but that won't be a function that's going to be passed on to
Senator Montes-Anderson. That's exactly right. So this is one of the big issues that Cover Oregon is working through today. So the arrangement that we had set up with both the carriers and the brokers made Cover Oregon a pass-through of funds. So when Cover Oregon receives commission payments from a carrier or an insurance company that need to be paid out to a broker, Cover Oregon simply goes and pays those out to the appropriate broker where those payments are due. In the event that a payment is not received from a carrier, we unfortunately cannot give those dollars to the broker where those funds are due, so we're unable to process those payments to the broker. So this has been a challenge for us over the past several months and has come to our attention a number of different times as payments are made to brokers and they notice variability in the amounts that they're being paid. Cover Oregon is actively working to ensure that all payments that are due to brokers related to 2014 are paid out, and that work will not end. So this is a big focus for us right now as our active ongoing work.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
A comment, if you could, about the brokers. Some of them, I understand, will not have every single policy available to some coming to their office that might be available through the exchange. In some parts of the state, when you have panels of physicians, as an example, the person purchasing the contract, purchasing the insurance, might be in a position of saying, is my doctor on that or not? And that would have to be answered by the broker, and they'd have to be able to say, products I'm selling don't include that. Maybe there's something else you can do. Would you make a few comments about that?
So Co-Chair Montes-Anderson, Co-Chair Greenlich, Senator Bates, one of the main differences, I think you've summarized it very well. So one of the main differences between 2014 and 2015 is, given that Cover Oregon was the broker of record, any agent that was appointed with Cover Oregon could sell any plan that was available through the insurance marketplace. In 2015, brokers are required to be appointed with any insurance company whose products they would like to sell via the marketplace. So the difference there is while brokers could sell any plan that was available through the marketplace in 2014, in 2015, brokers are only able to sell those plans from the insurers to whom they have been appointed. So the onus is placed on the insurer and the broker to ensure that those connections are made so a particular broker can sell that insurer's particular plan.
And it's paid differently depending on the plan, is that right?
Co-Chair Greenlich, is your question in relation to the commission payment to the brokers? That's correct. It's up to the insurance agency to determine how those commissions are paid to the brokers. And there is no standard in the industry at this point in time. One thing I did want to touch on here, my apologies, is training. So, and this is in relation to in-person assisters and navigators, but we also have a training function with brokers here in the state. So, There is federal training that brokers, agents, and in-person assisters were required to take through healthcare.gov, but Oregon has made the proactive decision to include additional training for these audiences to ensure that there's a local touch to the information that will be advised using healthcare.gov, if you will. Excuse me. So this is the brief summary slide. So The summary of the key functions are the review, approval, and certification of qualified health plans. Again, those are the private insurance plans. This includes Oregon-specific requirements for any benefit, any types of benefits or whatnot need to be built into those plans. Community partners and in-person assisters. Again, the state retains the responsibility of working with these groups to ensure that any place in the state, a consumer that would like to find assistance in going through the enrollment process, there is somebody trained to help them through that process, and that that person has met a standard that will ensure that that consumer is getting the best advice or information as possible. Public education and outreach. Again, it's the state's responsibility to ensure that people know what they need to do, when they need to do it, and what it means if they do not take action in relation to their own health insurance coverage. And stakeholder and tribal consultation. This is another important function that we carry on today, is listening to our partners and those who are most directly impacted by the decisions of the marketplace, the activities of the marketplace, and unfortunately over the course of 2014, the challenges of the marketplace. So we continue to be a sounding board for those audiences and work to make changes to meet their interests. So I also asked the staff to include a map of what the other states are doing. What you'll see is kind of the teal color here represents those state-based marketplace across the country. And you'll note that Oregon is included as a teal state. Again, supported state-based marketplace is not included in statute. The federal government does recognize that Oregon is using healthcare.gov as the technology. And that's why there's a little asterisk down in the right-hand corner that says Oregon and Nevada are supported state-based marketplaces using the federal technology. There are a couple other types of marketplaces. The maroon color, or the more red of the colors on the page, are those federally facilitated marketplaces. The purple color represents it's a marketplace where the state is operating its own shop but uses the full functions of the federally facilitated marketplace on the individual side. And then the light purple color represents partnership exchanges, which is a slight difference from those dark purple colors. It's very similar in nature, but is different. But I wanted to provide you with this to give you an overall view of where the country is right now in terms of its marketplaces. Our closest peer right now at this point in time is Nevada. They're in a very similar situation to our state. We do engage in conversation with them actively as we have both been going through these types of challenges as a state. I've included also a slide, and this is taken directly from the Oregon Insurance Division regarding the rates in 2015. These are specific to individual non-grandfathered plans. So the purpose of including this is just to demonstrate to you that there was rate change from 2014 to 2015. Some rates went up, most rates went down, but all in all, the purpose that the marketplace and the state set out to accomplish in terms of engaging carriers in competition and ensuring that Oregonians had a choice in what they could choose based upon the criteria with which they would like to shop is working. The thing that encourages me and I look forward to seeing in subsequent years is how these rates continue to change and the variability that continues to take place in the market and how the competition continues to evolve. So I just thought it would be good to include this slide to give you an idea of where the rates were on an average basis. In terms of numbers, we have one fewer carrier participating in 2015 than we did in 2014. However, there are more plans actually for sale in the 2015 exchange market than there were in 2014. And I'll stop there because it doesn't really get to the functions that we need to be mindful of and falls more into DCBS and OID. So I don't want to – I know I have folks coming after me that can probably speak better to that. And that's all the information I had actually prepared today. So I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have at this point in time.
One clarification. In my own eyes, I feel it's a function. For those people who are going to get tax credits, mm-hmm. They will – that will be determined once they file their 2014 income taxes. Mm-hmm. Because there is there's fluctuality between what they thought their revenue was going to be or their income was going to be and what it actually is. Mm-hmm. So is it the function of Cover Oregon to assist with the problems that might occur in April 15th? And can you just highlight that? Because I sort of feel that's part of a function of Cover Oregon right now, but maybe it isn't.
Co-Chair Montez Anderson, it's a great question. I think you're exactly right. And it kind of falls under that vague category of operation. So there's a lot of work that needs to take place to ensure that consumers are taken care of in these transactions. And as it relates to 2014 work, the advanced premium tax credit work is a very important part of that. So there is a large communication effort that needs to happen in order to ensure that all consumers that have shopped via the marketplace know what to do when they file their taxes in 2015 for the 2014 tax year. It's referred to, there's a document that will be distributed and is required to be distributed by the state marketplace called the 1095 form. This is a new tax form. It'll be very confusing to consumers. This isn't a problem that's unique to Oregon either. Every state will be challenged with this as they go through the process of educating consumers about how to file this information that's new regarding their health insurance for 2014. The responsibility of Cover Oregon as it relates to that 2014 year is making sure that consumers know what to do in that situation. So it is a function that we'll need to carry on. Obviously, the tax filing deadline is April 15th. However, given the newness of this process, we're anticipating a large number of Oregonians having to file for extensions, given the fact that folks will probably wait till the last minute to file their taxes. And then when they're asked, well, what's on your 1095 form, they probably or may not know what to do or where to look. So there is the potential for the tax filing season to extend further into 2015 than I think anyone is expecting at this point in time. It is a responsibility of the marketplace. Personally, I feel it. I feel responsible to Oregonians in ensuring that they know what to do as they get into this.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a follow-up on that, Mr. Patnod. So I would venture to guess that a significant percentage of the people who are receiving the APTC generally file a 1040EZ and don't itemize and don't do anything. Mm-hmm. How much complexity is this really going to add? And you just said you see it as a responsibility of the exchange to help people, especially in this first year. But could you talk a little bit more about how you envision that happening and whether this is going to require people to use a regular 1040?
So Co-Chair Montez Anderson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'm getting good at it. So,
you are.
Yeah. It is going to be very complicated. In terms of the ability of a household to use the 1040EZ form or having to use the normal 1040 form, I don't know the specific answer to that one, so I'll have to get back to you on it. What we are doing proactively is communicating with anyone who shopped through the marketplace in 2014 during the 2014 open enrollment period for coverage to ensure that when they receive the form, they know what to do with it.
Okay.
We've looked to the states of California and Kentucky, who have both built processes to distribute communications that will accompany the 1095 form that basically walk people through the process. Given the fact that we have had challenges in the determination and application of advanced premium tax credits for a number of folks here in the state, we will be including additional verbiage that will inform consumers about what they need to do if they feel they have been harmed by an application error and how to file a claim with Cover Oregon to be evaluated to see if they can receive payment to be made whole. That being said, Cover Oregon is responsible for issuing the 1095 form, just the form, but our letter will accompany it by no later than January 31st. We will have a communication plan associated with that distribution to ensure that we're providing as much assistance as we can to assist the consumers that will be receiving the form.
Follow up, if I may, quickly, Madam Chair. Thank you. So is it a safe assumption that you're also talking with Mr. Buchholz and his staff at DOR about this? Because if I had to guess, his staff is going to get a bunch of calls about this also.
So co-chairs Montez Anderson and Greenlick, Senator Steiner Hayward, we will be working with as many state partners as we can in order to ensure that any Oregonian that receives this form and needs to reach out for assistance will know what to do, where to go, and the most appropriate people to talk
Thank
to.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The ACA has been highly controversial, as everybody knows, and I frankly have always been basically in favor of it, but there was one place I was always concerned about, and that's interaction with the IRS. I thought it was too complicated, and I think we're going to enter into a certain kind of storm, which I can't use the word here. Is that storm? There are a lot of issues here, and I think it's going to be a national issue, what happens when that 1095 form goes out. Mm-hmm. The people who have been involved in this insurance issue probably haven't had to file extensive income tax returns before, probably haven't had to use a preparer. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to be extremely careful as a state to give out advice to these people mm-hmm. about how they should fill their forms out, mm-hmm. because that opens up to some form of liability mm-hmm. potentially there. So I'm not sure what you're going to be putting out as far as verbiage to them, mm-hmm. but I would suggest you have a good look at that with legal advice. Mm-hmm. And we do this very carefully. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a real storm. It's going to affect a lot of what we're doing on this committee. One, we'll have to decide when this transfer takes place. Mm-hmm. We may want to delay it into July as people extend in April if they can't figure out how to do their taxes. Mm-hmm. It's also going to affect this body from the point of view of we rely on a May forecast for setting our budget. There may be a big chunk of people that haven't filed. And that May forecast is important to us. It's the most accurate one we get. And if a lot of people haven't filed, we're not going to sure where we're going to be mm-hmm. as far as setting our overall budget for the state. So there's lots of really serious considerations here. Mm-hmm. But my caution would be, number one, we should all be prepared for the next storm in this situation. Mm-hmm. We've already gone through one enrollment, which is now working. The next storm is this coming up, and be ready to try to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a very difficult time, I believe, and it's going to make us think twice about how fast we move you over.
Representative Nathanson. Thank you, Madam Chair. It might be that my question is better answered by DCBS. I haven't been looking ahead to see what that presentation may include. But you have a slide. First of all, I'll mention that on slide 3, you provide us the triple aim. One of those is reduce the per capita cost of mm-hmm. health care. Mm-hmm. There are two different things that we talk about in cost, the cost of health care mm-hmm. and the cost of insurance, mm-hmm. health insurance. It's two different kinds of numbers. In the past, for a number of years, we had been using the phrase bending the cost curve mm-hmm. so that the increase, which had been steep, and the increase in cost of health insurance, maybe people were seeing even 20-25% annual increases in their health insurance premium. Mm-hmm. Bending the cost curve didn't mean an absolute reduction in price. It meant a slower increase. So in the numbers that I see on the slide, either the last, on this one, mm-hmm. it's a little hard for me to tell whether you will be able to provide to us either right now, you could do it on a mm-hmm. spreadsheet, or sometime in the future, if you could look back to information that had been provided to us 2 years ago and 4 years ago mm-hmm. showing that cost mm-hmm. curve and how this translates mm-hmm. to that so that we're comparing apples mm-hmm. to apples.
So co-chairs Montez Anderson and Greenlick, Representative Nathanson, I think it's a very good question. I think you're right. I think perhaps DCBS and the insurance division are probably better folks to provide an exact answer to you. I think one of the challenges in providing that graph, if you will, is taking into consideration the mandate of the essential health benefits package, which in essence increased the cost of insurance coverage regardless by setting that baseline of benefit coverage that needed to be provided in every insurance plan. So I think given, 2 years of exchange activity or 2 years since the advent of the exchange is difficult really to, it would tell a different story because you would see the dramatic increase in cost given the baseline setting of the essential health benefits package. I think from the beginning,
it's not the increase in cost. The increase in premium, not the increase in
correct.
Cost.
Premium cost, I'm sorry. I should have made that specific delineation. But you would see the increase in the insurance premium cost. I think over time, what the goal is to see that steady decline, as you've indicated in your comments. But again, I think it's a market question, probably better served answered by DCBS or the OID.
And colleagues, I want to make sure that we keep our questions relevant to the issue of transition rather than and what we have in the LC, just in the interest of time. Okay. And Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In light of that, I do have transition questions. Thank you. A couple of them. Could you just briefly, and round numbers is fine, how many individuals are enrolled now?
Mm-hmm.
How many of those you anticipate sending 1095s to? Because mm-hmm. that's only 6 weeks ago, so you should have some rough numbers because mm-hmm. you're planning for this. And roughly the value of those potential tax credits?
Sure. So in relation to co-chairs Mona's Anderson, Representative mm-hmm. Greenlick, Senator Boquist, specifically in relation to 2014.
Yes.
Okay.
President.
So at this point in time, ballpark numbers for 2014. As of December 1st, we have about 70,000 QHP enrollees. Of those 70,000, about 65,000 of them have effectuated their policy, so have paid their first month's premium. In industry standards, about 80 to 90%. We're at about 89.5%. So in relation to the question of, well, what's the number of people that will be receiving advanced premium tax credit at some point in the course of 2014? It's about northwards of 40, 45,000 households. In terms of the value of those, it's difficult to say at this point in time because it's all based on projected income. So when an individual or a household went to apply for their advanced premium tax credits, they estimated what their income would be for the year. So we can't say with any level of accuracy what the actual amount would be, given the fact that they haven't received their W-2s, made deductions, exemptions, et cetera. So when we have those numbers, I'd be happy to provide them to the committee.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam. Mm-hmm. And when do you, other than the ballpark, because we're going to have to make a decision,
mm-hmm.
and as Senator Bates said, at some point we have a May forecast, and so we now know there's at least 45,000 tax returns mm-hmm. in question, and there's got to be some value for our good economists to look at. And as you know, and we've had this discussion mm-hmm. personally, mm-hmm. previously from the Oversight Committee, we had challenges getting accurate numbers or even accurate swags.
Right.
Because we can't say that other word.
Yeah.
An accurate range of what our potential mm-hmm. liability
sure.
and so on and so forth. And I think that's a very keen mm-hmm. fact to know of how much are we talking, whether it's, you know, $1 million range or whether it's a $25 mm-hmm. million in
yeah.
the future.
Thank Senator you. Boquist, I think that's a great point. We're actually continuing to work with our external firm and trying to get to exactly those numbers to understand the scope of both households and financial impact. If and when we're able to arrive at that number, we'd be happy to provide it to you. What we have been doing as part of our plan is working with our liability insurer to determine if this would be covered under our liability policy. So it may not have a direct impact to the budgeting process, but we'll inform you more as those plans become as those plans are put in place.
Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for testifying. What's your current cash burn rate per month, and if you were to continue it to exist into 2015, what would you expect in terms of FTE staffing levels and your cash per month that you go through?
Mm-hmm. So, co-chairs, Representative Davis, we're, as you know, we're operating on federal grant funds for 2014. The work that Ham Street and Associates had done early in 2014 estimated northwards of $1 million a month as the budgeted burn rate for the operation. For the past 4 months or so, we have been consistently under that burn rate, which is generating a contingency fund, if you will, or unused federal grant dollars that we estimate to be about $9 million by the end of 2014. That being said, we've filed for a no-cost extension for those federal dollars for the duration of 2015. and the federal government has acknowledged that no-cost extension will allow us to use those federal dollars during 2015, but only as it relates to 2014 work. So a lot of this, the tax issues that we're talking about would come under that. That being said, what does 2015 look like? 2015 was always indicated as a year that all state-based marketplaces needed to be self-sustaining. So we are going through a very stringent budgeting process at this point in time and downsizing our organization from being a $90 million organization for 2014 to being closer to a $15 to $20 million organization for $90 million organization for 14 to being closer to a $15 to $20 million organization for 2015. We do not have an approved budget yet from our Finance and Audit Committee or our Board of Directors. We are taking up those issues tomorrow at both of those meetings, as they will both be convening during the day. So what I will tell you is from a headcount perspective, we are going from when I started in July at Cover Oregon, we had about 150 employees. Today we have about 90 just through normal attrition. By the middle of 2015, we're budgeting to have about 45 employees, which is more in line with the sustainability that we need to achieve as a marketplace.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, thank you very much, Mr. Patnoid. And we'd like to move to the next agenda item, overview of LC 1203, and Lori Freeman, who's Senior Deputy Counsel. Will you please come forward? Welcome.
Mr. and Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I've been asked to go through the draft LC 1203, which, as I told the co-chairs earlier today, as I was preparing for this, I saw some mistakes in it, so I hope we get another shot at it.
I guarantee you get another shot at it.
Shame on you
before
for asking.
The 3,000 amendments come in.
Yeah, there we are.
The main thrust of this, obviously, is to transfer the functions of the Cover Oregon over to DCBS and abolish Cover Oregon. But it's also to try to maintain the flexibility that Oregon has to either continue with the supported state-based marketplace or to even go to a fully, entirely state-based marketplace in the future. So for the most part, the bill just transfers functions. And I'm just going to hit a few of the pieces that sort of highlights of the bill. So Section 1 abolishes the Board of Directors, and that section is the operative date, or it goes into effect on the effective date of the bill, and the bill has an emergency clause. So that would be whatever day the governor signs the bill. So that goes into effect right away. And then 60 days after the effective date, you have Section 2, and under that, the corporation is abolished and the executive director is dismissed. Subsection 3 of that section was added to make clear that the employees of Cover Oregon are not public employees for purposes of the transfer provisions that protect them and allow them to be transferred into another position of public employment. The next sections after that are pretty much our boilerplate that we use when we abolish an agency and transfer it. It's pretty amazing we have a boilerplate for that, but we do. Section 5, this basically says all the liabilities that under any action or proceeding, so I'm sure everyone wants to know what happens with the Oracle litigation, that all of that just gets transferred and DCBS gets substituted for Cover Oregon. Let's see. So Section 14, which begins on page 8, is really the heart of the showing you what Section 14 followed by Section 15, what is being transferred to DCBS. And as you can see, I mean, basically we're saying Cover Oregon is still going to be responsible for the exchange. The exchange is still going to have the same goals, legislative intent. It's just now going to be administered, and we use that sort of in a loose way, by DCBS. In Section 15, which begins on 9 and then goes further, you'll see that for the most part all these functions remain, and we've added a couple of new ones too on page 11, and those were just functions that we were told HHS was insisting that the supported state-based exchange continue to provide, and so we made that explicit. The only thing that's really missing is you'll find on pages 12 to 13, it's just the language about the corporation's ability to enter into contracts and sue and be sued and own property and that sort of thing. On page 16, it used to be that the health insurance exchange would establish the fees and charges imposed on insurers. And now DCBS is going to do that, but they're going to be advised by a health insurance exchange advisory committee. And this bill specifies who's on that advisory committee.
Boy, where are you?
Well, I'm moving on. That was Section 16 on page 13.
Oh, page 13.
Okay. So, one of the things we've done is we've taken all the Cover Oregon statutes that were in 741, we've essentially moved them to DCBS. So that, and made it part of the insurance code. So DCBS will have all the enforcement authority that it has for other provisions of the insurance code with respect to Cover Oregon. Let's see, page 16, section 18. The change we made there was saying, in subsection 1, saying who can participate in the exchange. We removed employers, and this is because under the supported state-based exchange, the state has to operate a separate shop. So originally, the health insurance exchange was going to have a combined exchange for both employers and individuals, and it was all going to go through one uniform exchange. But since we're now using the federal technology, we're going to have a separate exchange for the employers. And so they're taken out of the participation from the health insurance exchange, and elsewhere we've directed DCBS to set up a shop. Let's see. Thank you, Sandy. Must be that peanut butter sandwich I ate. let's see. So I just wanted to say we have a heading conforming amendments, and they are pretty much all just changing Cover Oregon to DCBS or making internal cross-reference changes. But there were was a couple of things I wanted to bring to your attention, because you might want to address this. And on page 30, this is part of Section 26, originally the Oregon Health Policy Board was charged really with having a role in developing the certification requirements for plans and rate review, and they were supposed to be consulting with Cover Oregon. On page 30, lines 13 through 15, you'll see that we're taking out the functions of the Oregon Health Policy Board advising about health insurance. So I don't know if that's something that the committee will want to continue with or just pull it back out, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. And similarly, on page 34.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
That wasn't specifically in relation to the exchange, was it? Wasn't that?
No, it was health insurance, Mr. Co-Chair.
General issue.
General health insurance issues.
So why didn't we change it here, that bill around the exchange?
Well, it's listed as a conforming amendment because, as far as I can tell, other than the original selection of a benchmark, Oregon Health Policy Board has really played no role in the health insurance market or in consulting with DCBS.
I'm sure that's something we specifically want to make sure we mm-hmm. intend to do that.
Right. And then there's a similar issue that comes up on page 34. And again, this is the Oregon Health Authority, not the board this time, but the Oregon Health Authority has a responsibility to do the things in lines 13 through 18. And this has to do, again, with administrative expenses for health insurers, approval of rates, and that sort of thing. So if you want to leave that with the Oregon Health Authority, I just want to bring that to your attention. And then in section
Page 34,
I'm sorry.
Lines 13.
Yeah, I'm just
13 through 19. And then on page 36, section 30, this is where we've had this ability of DHS and the exchange to cross-delegate functions. And so in this section, we've just replaced the reference to the exchange corporation to DCBS. So DCBS and DHS will continue to be able to cross-delegate functions. And I'm sorry, and the Oregon Health Authority. And you'll see throughout the bill, I've changed the definition to health insurance exchange as defined in the federal statute, and that is to make it sort of just a generic health insurance exchange and allow us the flexibility that whether we have the federal government doing the technology or even if we were to do the technology, the definition would still apply. The only other thing that is a might be something of a substantive change is in section 40 on page 58. And we've just moved the definition of catastrophic plan that used to be for the insurance code to just this section. And we did that because this is the only section where the term is used. But under the definition before it was moved, catastrophic plans could only be offered through the health insurance exchange, but we were told by DCBS that that's no longer permitted, or there's been guidance saying that's not permitted. So this definition says that it does not limit it to plans offered through the exchange. And I think those are the highlights.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much. Ms. Freeman, thank you as always for both your remarkable drafting skills and your lucid explanations. I don't know how you do it. Frankly, it's really cool. The one question I have is we're starting to see some new kinds of insurance products available in the Oregon market, programs that have been recently approved by health providers that have now been approved to have insurance products. Will those in any way under this current version be excluded? They would be permitted, I think, as being offered under the federal law, but this version of, at least at the moment, wouldn't preclude those from being offered via the exchange, would it?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner here, would they, as long as, if there are plans that are subject to regulation by the insurance division, or DCBS, if they're considered the transaction of insurance and they have to have a certificate of authority, then they would be eligible for the exchange.
Okay.
The statutes only exclude coordinated care organizations and what used to be the managed care organizations, Medicaid managed care organizations.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Freeman.
Yeah. Senator. Oh, yes. Representative Kinnemer and then Bates and then Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. I guess in my efforts to try and read through this, it seems to me that it is fair to characterize it as a very carefully focused and purely administrative directive. I do not see evidence of efforts to change policy regarding health care. In fact, I think it's purposely deleted, but I just want to clarify that. It's not discussing some of the issues of who may be a provider or what kinds of services may be provided or what reimbursement rates there might be or some of these tedious things that we often get into considerable controversy in this committee about. Tedious and, well, yeah. Well, it's hard to find the right word, isn't it? But anyhow, I just wanted to say that is correct. We really have pretty much, we're talking about the transition of administration of the exchange, not the functions of the delivery of service.
Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Kinnemer, that is exactly right. We have strived to just maintain the status quo, but just move all the functions to DCBS. And the money too.
Yeah.
Move the money.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Bates. And then.
Just a couple quick questions. Lori, thank you for your work again. I'm going to ask you a couple questions, which you may not know the answer to, but if you can get back to me later, I'd appreciate it. Under the ACA, we've heard today that the issuance of the 1095 form is the responsibility of the exchange, which struck me as strange, but maybe that's what it was, not the IRS. And if it's not the responsibility of the IRS, and we have to, the exchange has to do this, what's their liability for putting that out? I mean, getting it to everybody, making it something they can understand, all those things. Are we actually requiring the exchange to put out an IRS form to people buying this insurance? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, I don't know a lot about the tax portion of it, but what little I do know is I believe it's just like a W-2 that you get from your employer or the tax forms that you get from your, IRAs and other financial institutions. It's the responsibility of the institution, whoever is paying you the money to send you the form, and then you file that with your taxes. So I'm not sure if we would, I'm presuming we wouldn't have to do that for 2015, for 2016 filings for 2015, right, since we're not doing the tax credits.
And a different question.
Cover Oregon can answer that.
We'll talk to Revenue about that too. A separate question, and I think you may have answered it already, actually. When this transfer occurs, right now, as I understand it, the exchange is looking at what qualified plans are, adequacy of panels and reserves and all that sort of thing. I assume that when that transfers back to DCBS, DCBS does that for other insurance models, but this stays inside the exchange when this transfer occurs. It doesn't slide over to the rest of the DCBS because they do it for other issues, but not for this one. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Bates, I this doesn't get to that level of specificity about, where it goes within DCBS. DCBS already does rate review for all plans, regardless of whether they're offered through the exchange. And now they'll do the certification process for plans offered through the exchange.
Okay. We'll follow that up with when DCBS gets up here. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. About three short questions, but Senator Bates just prodded my memory here. You just made a statement a minute ago, Lori, that said we won't have to be dealing with tax credits for these forms in 2015. Would you elaborate there? I mean, the tax credits are all going away? I mean, because the 1090, the 1095 is virtually like a 1099 form, so it's just coming. Yeah, so it's going to come in. So I think we're still going to be giving tax credits, which means even if we transition the function, I think you've said here, is that function of issuing the tax credit will be under the new entity. Am I correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Boquist, I really can't answer that question. I was referring to the 1095 forms, since the federal government will be doing the tax credits in the next plan year. I assume that the federal government would be issuing the 1095 forms, but I don't know. Anyone back there could probably answer that better than me.
Before I go on to my next question, Madam Kutcher, if you would, I think it's just kind of a follow-up offline with you, because, I mean, it raises all kinds of issues, given the Supreme Court decision and whether it's a federal exchange versus a state exchange, and we're back at the beginning of how many tax forms, how much money in the liability. So I'd like to follow up outside of this, with, maybe with DOER. Actually, my real question that I started with, you said several went back and we started talking about the employer exchange has to be separate in order to meet, I think, the Section 11, the Affordable Health Care Act. And so we're going to authorize them to create a new exchange for small employers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Boquist, it's currently we have a process, and I'm sure someone from Cover Oregon can address this better than I can, but there is a process now for small employers who enrolled in plans that would be qualified health plans were they offered through the exchange to get their tax credits. And so that's sort of our own version of the SHOP. The way this bill is structured, we can either do like a formal SHOP exchange, you know, where they go in and they go into their computer, or we can continue the process that we're doing now.
My last question, if you would indulge me, Madam Co-Chair. We've exchanged a lot of notes since I was on Cover Oregon Oversight Committee, as you all know here. And in the transition that comes over presently now, 10 of 17 functions required under Section 1311, we do. We're required eventually, I believe, to do all 17. And in your mind, is the new version or the draft we have LC from us going to ensure that DCBS, if they're the recipient, are going to have to perform all the 17 functions? And I think the biggest function most of us are interested in is number 17, that is the financial data that's not transparent yet.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Boquist, this bill doesn't get into the specificity of what's in the federal statute. So the federal statute says that they have to make this financial data available. We don't have any reference to that in our statute. But presumably, since DCBS is running it, that will be part of the blueprint, which has been submitted to HHS and hasn't yet been approved. But I assume the blueprint will cover whose responsibilities that will be.
Right. And just a comment, Madam Co-Chair, I don't think any of the members or anybody in the legislature has seen even the draft blueprint. So. That is an issue. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. As you know, I'm kind of new on this committee, and I'm just kind of trying to wade through things, and I see things that I don't normally see in legislation, and I'm referring to Section 11. You kind of went over that a little faster than I would have liked, where the director may take actions prior to the operative date. Now, is the operative date different than the date that this document's going to be signed? And if it's not, then I'm trying to figure out how you could do that, because the authority comes with the signature, but you've given him the authority prior to the signature. So I'm kind of curious. I've never seen that before, and it just kind of threw me for a loop.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Girard, that's actually fairly standard language. We use it when we have an emergency clause on a bill, so the bill goes into effect the date the governor signs it, but it has a later operative date. So it's the difference between the effective date and the operative date. Okay. And the effective date of the bill has an emergency clause, so the minute the governor signs it, it's effective. But if you go to the very end, it'll say that most of the other sections other than Section 1 and the provisions directly related to the Board of Directors of Cover Oregon don't go into effect until 60 days after the effective date. So this would allow, once the bill is signed, it would allow DCBS to start doing all the things it needs to do so that 60 days after the operative or the effective date, it's transferred.
Okay. Senator, our Representative Kenny Geyer?
No, I'll actually wait till after that.
Okay. And Representative
Green. I'd like to follow on this because I am most concerned that we have a smooth transition, a smooth handoff. And I'm not sure that the effective dates allow that to happen. Is there, right now one of the problems is Cover Oregon dies and goes away, and the next midnight, I mean that night, DCBS has a lot of responsibility without staff or without any ability to do those things. And perhaps when Mr. Allen comes up, we can talk about that. But it seems to me we need to stretch out that transition in a way that we make sure people who know what they're doing can finish up the 2014 business, most particularly. Would we do that by changing the effective dates, the active dates, whatever those terms are? I mean, is that the way to make sure, to assure we have a legitimate transition period?
Mr. Co-Chair, the only thing that happens on day one when the governor signs the bill is the board of directors is abolished. So the executive director and the corporation and all the employees of the corporation continue until the operative date, 60 days later. So, you know, obviously that's your call, your all of your call, how long you want to give them from the date the bill goes into effect to the date the transfer has to be a done deal.
May I follow that?
Mm-hmm.
At the operative date, that means there are no employees of Cover Oregon. They're all gone, right? And they haven't necessarily moved over on an interim basis. Would there be a way? I know you want to avoid the public employee transfer responsibilities, and you do that. But would there be a way that we could give Mr. Allen more ability to get some staff? Is that allowed under this model? Could he say these 32 people move over to DCBS now? Or have we eliminated that by doing away with Cover Oregon at the same time we transfer the activities to
Mr. Chair, that relates to Senator Girard's comment on Section 11, which allows DCBS to take any action before the operative date necessary to effectuate it on the operative date. So, sure, he could move all of his employees or one of his employees or whatever he wanted to do during that time. But as I understand, it would have to be a new regular hiring process. It wouldn't be under the public employee transfer provisions.
Thank you. Yes, and Senator Buckwith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Three of us up here has a rather interesting experience on the last Advisory Oversight Committee, and when Representative the good Co-Chair made mention about, yeah, should have done a little long time ago. You're very familiar with the authorities we had and did not have in the advisory committee as we implemented that. And three of us here were on that four-person committee. In your mind, is the advisory committee that you've put in the draft statute have enough teeth or more to prevent what just happened over the past couple of years, at least in our minds as legislators? Is there more meat in there that committee has some authority?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the advisory committee in here is just to the DCBS, so they don't have oversight over the transition or any of that, but they do have very specific functions that are set out in the statute that says, you know, they're responsible for making recommendations to DCBS on the fee, the charge that's assessed on insurers, and determining whether or not employees have minimal essential coverage and a bunch of other things. So they're all pretty specific in the bill. But again, they're recommendations, so they're just an advisory committee.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. We're for all your good hard work. We need to move on. I'd like to call Patrick Allen, director of DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, forward.
Thanks, Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Before we get started, I just wanted to particularly, as several of you have, thank Lori Freeman for her great work on this. We've had some opportunity just in the very recent past to interact with her on bill language, and it's been a great process on a lot of complex material that she's just been super to work with and very helpful. My job here today is to not talk with you in great depth about American healthcare policy and its implementation in Oregon. My job is to talk to you about legislative concept 1203 that transfers the remaining functions of Cover Oregon to the Department of Consumer and Business Services if you should choose to do that. at the outset, I think it's important to, just for context, to note, to make sure everyone's up on the same page to understand, the original version of Cover Oregon was quite broader than what is at Cover Oregon today. The Medicaid-related functions have, in fact, already devolved back to the Oregon Health Authority, and so we're talking about the remaining functions of Cover Oregon, and I think that's important. What I'd like to do today is you've already seen an overview from Mr. Patnode about state-based marketplace. I'll touch on that just again briefly to do a little bit of reinforcing of a couple of key points. We'll talk about many of you are not on committees that the department deals with regularly, and so I'll spend just a brief moment or two talking about what the agency is and what it does and what it's responsible for and how it works. We'll suggest to you our working model right now for how we would operate this were we to receive this function, talk about a project plan and then some notion of risk and mitigations that's actually going to be more worked in throughout. At the outset, I should say my language hopefully is deferential to the notion of this is a proposal that you may or may not choose to act on. However, once this became kind of a live idea that we knew was out there, we did assemble a project team within the organization to start beginning to do some fairly detailed implementation planning. And so I might start talking like you've already made that decision, and I apologize for that. That said, what we've not had the opportunity to do because of sensitivity around, you know, not knowing exactly what was going to be proposed in the draft until it came out, we have not until just recently had the opportunity to sit down directly with Cover Oregon and begin doing very detailed transition planning. And many of the questions that you've asked today are the kinds of things that when we come back in January, we'll be able to have much, much more specific answers to as we work with them on getting a better understanding of exactly what's going to need to happen for that transition. Chief among them being that what we think would be the appropriate effective date for the bill, and what are those actions that can be taken before the effective date as well as after the effective date that can make that transition smoother. So that's my general game plan for you this afternoon. So you've already heard from Mr. Patnode the notion of what is an exchange and what are the requirements and those kinds of things. I just want to talk about briefly about the importance of whatever we do in this or any other legislative concept, maintaining our status as a state-based exchange. It's really quite critical, we believe, from a policy standpoint. I'm not going to read through everything that's on this slide, but I want to talk about two things in particular. The tax credit question that Senator Boqvist has raised is quite critical. As you know, there's a Supreme Court case pending right now that really the crux of it is if you're on the federal exchange, you can't have tax credits. If you're on a state exchange, you can. And as you heard, the supported state-based exchange isn't something that exists in federal law. And so we need to maintain the flexibility to be able to be identified as a state-based exchange. And so anything that you might think about doing in the draft that would dial in particular technology or structure answers with respect to the federal government. We should think cautiously about doing that because of that impact. The other thing just to touch on quickly is from a cost effectiveness standpoint, were you to be of a mind to consider, well, let's just send the whole thing to the feds, not worried about the tax credit issue, let's let them handle it, you would lose the ability to make a lot of policy decisions around qualified health plans here at the local level. You might have some risk around tax credits, and it would cost more. The federal assessment rates that get folded into insurance rates are higher than the rates set in Oregon, and so you know, I think that kind of an option were you to consider it really talks about paying more to get less. I'll just do it this way. All right, so a quick bit of 101 about Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're the state's largest consumer protection and business regulatory agency. Our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. That positive business climate element is not just sort of a throwaway line. We think of those consumer and worker protection elements as co-equal with the business climate elements. There are a number of reasons for that. This is a review for Representative Kenny Geyer from 2 hours ago. I gave her an overview in her committee. But that notion of our business climate being attractive to the providers of financial and other consumer services and products is really critical. We have, according to the American Medical Association from about 2 years ago, the most competitive private health insurance market in the country. We think that number of health insurance companies with the number of plans and offerings they offer to Oregonians is itself a powerful consumer protection tool, because one of the best ways to keep you on your toes is having competitors who are willing to take the business if you don't take care of that. That doesn't substitute for vigorous regulation, but it's an important part of our philosophy. From a subject matter standpoint, we do most of the financial regulation in the state. That ranges from banks and credit unions and insurance companies, who are regulating not just for their consumer protection practices but for their financial safety and soundness, to retail consumer lending kinds of programs, pawnbrokers, money transmitters, all sorts of assorted kinds of financial service providers. We are responsible for the state's worker safety and workers' compensation system. That's an integrated system that starts from a standpoint of making sure workers are kept safe in the workplace, and then regulates the system that deals with what happens if they are injured in the workplace. We are the regulator of the workers' compensation insurance system. We have standards for how claims get paid and all those sorts of things. And then construction safety is a part of our mission as well. The Building Codes Division is responsible for primarily establishing the construction standards in the state, but also administering the system delivered through local governments to do plan review and inspections and those kinds of things that that deal with construction safety. So really that's a snapshot to give you an idea that we already are an agency with a broad portfolio of missions and functions, but with a theme oriented toward consumer protection and a positive business climate. We have a couple of semi-independent functions, and that'll become relevant here in a minute. The Workers' Compensation Board adjudicates workers' compensation disputes as well as disputes regarding OSHA. They are actually a separate agency, but they're housed within us for administrative purposes. And then what I really want to point to are the ombudsman's functions. We have a workers' compensation small business ombudsman and an ombudsman for injured workers. Those are functions that are part of the workers' compensation system, but they're not part of the Workers' Compensation Division. They report directly to me provide an arm's length relationship between their advocacy work on behalf of small businesses and injured workers and the regulatory work of the division. And we'll come back to that when I talk about the structure that we're proposing for how we would execute this. And then, of course, we have the standard portfolio of central services that go with an agency of 900 people. And again, that'll become relevant here in just a minute. So let me talk a bit about how we would propose to execute this function were the LC to be adopted and we get responsibility for this. Rather than putting this function in the insurance division, since its mission is really rather different than the regulatory mission and functions of the division, we would propose to set up a freestanding unit somewhat similar in concept to the ombudsman's functions that we have now, so that there would be a unit singularly focused on the successful delivery of these exchange services. To be sure, it would draw on the insurance division for a variety of expertise, much as Cover Oregon does today in terms of plan certification and those kinds of issues. It would also draw on the rest of the agency in terms of accounting and financial services, business services, human resources, and so on. But I think it's important, if one of the original challenges was a lack of single point of accountability, this LC, I think, does a couple of things, does one thing that I would want to echo in how we execute this. The department is unitary. There is only the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the director. There aren't subdivisions of the department in statute. And so if you give this function to us, I'm the person who's accountable to you for its delivery. I would want to make sure that I've got a single unit of people who are accountable for no mission other than the successful delivery of this program, because I think that's critical to being able to succeed. The unit would, on our org chart, it would probably look like a division. I don't think it would be anything like the size of our typical divisions, which usually are 100 people or more. But it would have that kind of autonomy and focus. And focus and report to me as a part of what we do. The bill envisions our having the ability to enter into intergovernmental agreements with the Health Authority, Department of Revenue, others that we may need to execute parts of these services. For an example, our call center services. And I know there's some question about what's the exact right way to do that. What I would suggest is our working model to this point has been to take advantage of existing call center functions around this cluster of issues in the state from an efficiency standpoint. At the end of the day, as I just said, I'm the one who's accountable for making sure these things are delivered effectively, and I can assure you that as a part of any kind of an IGA we would enter into, we would need to be dealing with the things that you always do around metrics and performance standards and those kinds of things to make sure that we're able to have the service delivered for Oregonians that we need to have delivered. And at the end of the day, that's permissive language, not building the structure into statute, which, again, I would advise against. You've already talked somewhat extensively about the advisory committee. I just wanted to draw your attention to the notion that conceptually, if not literally in language, this is broadly patterned after the Management Labor Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation. If you've dealt in those areas, you know that's a committee that doesn't have a lot of authority statutorily to tell me what to do. By your behavior and by over time governor's behaviors around what you will or won't consider in terms of changes to the workers' compensation system, you have vested them with broad authority to basically render an opinion on what changes should or shouldn't be made to the workers' compensation system, and then you tend to take that advice. But you won't find that as some sort of a statutory veto or some kind of a required step that has to be passed. And there have been many changes over the years to workers' compensation law that you've done without the Management Labor Advisory Committee buying off. The key function that I think is here, though, in this draft that makes a difference is they have an independent reporting relationship to you, the legislature. So so they've got the ability to communicate directly to you and say, hey, we think there's something going on that you need to know about, or there's a decision being made that we think there are issues about, and presumably we won't have a lot of that. But the idea is they can't be filtered by me. I can't be a shortstop that keeps them from getting information to you. And I think that's an important oversight role that they are able to play. Also, unlike a lot of advisory committees, these are, as currently drafted, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And so you've also got the confirmation process as a further lever on that. I want to talk briefly about financial sustainability. We're not in a position to really be able to talk in hard numbers and FTE and those kinds of things about the system. We have mainly focused on assuring ourselves that we believe this can be managed in a financially sustainable fashion within the existing assessment parameters that are currently in place, and we are more than cautiously optimistic. I think we believe we're in good shape to be able to do that. By January, we would expect to be able to come back to you, again, after we've done some of that detailed transition planning with Cover Oregon, to speak more specifically about fiscal impacts and those kinds of things. But that's our aim throughout, is to make sure that we can, that working within the existing assessment framework, we're able to deliver this, and I think we can. There are a couple of reasons for that, and probably first and foremost, that there are some efficiencies we can just get just by by virtue of the fact that we're rolling this into an existing 900-person agency that already has robust central business services functions that I already talked about in terms of IT and accounting and human resources and those kinds of things. And so in most of these areas, we're talking about incremental increases to work that we already do rather than having to create freestanding, self-contained functions along those lines that a separate organization needs to do. And we believe there are potential savings to be able to be achieved there. I want to talk just briefly about SHOP, as I know you already have. SHOP is a more complex than you would expect kind of a dynamic for a couple of reasons. There are federal decisions that seem always to be in flux. Will the small business mandate, in fact, go forward when the small business mandate is supposed to go forward? Will the definition of small business increase from 50 to 100 when it's expected to? And those are things that we clearly can't control. We've also got some dynamics in the state that cause us to there are things that we can do to facilitate delivery of SHOP if we make some changes to other systems that their own complex decisions. So, for example, right now it's difficult for us to use the federal technology on SHOP because of the way we design small business group rates. Well, that's something that we control within rule, and we can go and make that change, but there are policy implications about that. And so that's a kind of a long-winded way of saying the law requires us to deliver SHOP. There are options about how we'll do that. It's difficult as we sit here today in December to talk about exactly what the right strategy is for delivering that until some of those dominoes fall into place a little bit later in the year. The key risk really is the notion that the timing is what you've already been talking about the implementation, the effective date of the bill and the timing to get this lined out in time to be ready for open enrollment in October. The language that allows us to begin to act before the effective date of the bill is extremely helpful. The single point of accountability, I've already talked about getting the advisory committee up and running quickly. And really, again, as I've said before, getting the organizations together right now as we are to deal with the detailed transition and implementation planning is what will give us a leg up. That plus the work that we've done over about the last 90 days trying to what I've told people is start acting as though this bill has already passed short of, you know, making decisions and spending money, because if we don't, we'll be perpetually behind the curve. And so we've kind of really taken that to heart and tried to move to get as much pinned down with what we know as we can. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions that you might have.
Questions? Yes. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair. Thank you for your presentation and willingness to consider taking this on. One of the three things I think of as really critical in this are the transparency, the accountability, which is both financial accountability, but also is the program doing what it aims to do in terms of really serving the needs of Oregonians that need health insurance, and are we running it cost-effectively? And the area in this particular draft, I think this is really focused on the technical transition pieces, but I want to make sure that in this legislation we're not missing an opportunity to think very hard about how we want to set out the expectations for what Cover Oregon will do. And I think one of the primary places to do that is in the advisory committee. And I noticed that it seems, in my view, quite bare on page number 6 in terms of what we're asking the advisory committee to do. I would hope that the advisory committee would also advise you on how to get consumer feedback. I think that's a really critical piece to this. So I hope that to me is one of the most critical things. Page 8 also refers to the report back that you do, as well as the advisory committee. Advisory committee, I think, is on page 7, but what you do on page 8. And I would hope that we would include some of the required elements of that annual report to the legislature to contain things like insurance packages, number and demographics of enrollees, the subsidies, the community feedback and satisfaction. Those are some of the meat of what this is trying to do. And I know that we don't want to get too prescriptive, so we don't want to go out and tell you how to get that feedback. I'm hoping the advisory committee will work with you on that. But I do think that the legislation needs to have some of those goals, so it gets to the heart of what we want Cover Oregon to do.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you, and I agree completely. In terms of oversight and accountability and reporting back, I think one of the strengths of this approach is this brings this function back under standard legislative oversight, and I think we've built a reasonably good track record as an agency of one that's transparent and accountable and provides good information. But I think anything that the bill adds to that that reinforces that is helpful. I think when we talked on the phone, I joked that my expectation is to have to drop by each of your living rooms once a month and kind of give you a personal update of what's going on everything up to and including that. I think we welcome. In terms of the structure of the advisory committee, again, I think I'm relatively agnostic about the things that you believe it should deal with. What you talked about are things that I would have of natural course bring to an advisory committee. About the only place where I would start getting a little bit nervous is if you start drifting off into the notion of it having decision-making authority, where we then dilute that single point of accountability, where are there decisions I get to make and decisions somebody else gets to make, and then if something goes wrong, we each get to point at the other because they're the ones who made whatever decision, and that would make me more nervous.
Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Pat, appreciate the information. I appreciate the conference call beforehand and the stuff there. And so I have some questions, but I'm not looking for any answers today.
Okay.
But having been one of the individuals that saw the natural course of action being on the last advisory committee, I can assure you that riding on a rail or tarring feathering is neither one of those are very good. So
I appreciate that sentiment.
We've had that discussion. A couple of things that jump out to me, I mean, everybody here wants the transition to go good, and we got to go someplace. We know that in some form or the other. That's where I think bipartisanship probably ends, or either side, so on and so forth. But a couple of things that jumped out for you to consider to bring back in January that really got me is that the present authority that's going over, if counsel was correct in here, you know, we've taken the liability away from us being responsible for the present 90 employees over there and the 45 that might be there in June as we come forward, which I think she specifically stated you have to use the natural hiring process that we have in state right now. For those that's run this before, I mean, to cover Oregon now, they've come a long ways. And so now they got it down and they know what they're doing. And if you terminate 90 people or 45 people and now you magically on day 60, you're going to take it over, I don't see that as a transition. I see it as a running off the cliff. So you guys got to come back with January with a bloody plan and probably exceptions to what we're going to make this world, because there's a lot of talent over there. I'm surprised I'm the one saying this. A lot of talent over there that you've got to have up and running in overnight and light switch like that. I think when you come back, one of the things that I need to see, and we've had this discussion before, is we don't have any of the dollar and cents answers. I don't know if you've seen the blueprint, but none of us have. That whole number 17 of section 1311 of the code is the big thing to us, is what does this cost, who's coming over, how much is it going to be, and what is it we're really buying in DCBS to go forward. And so you and Cover Oregon got a whole lot of homework to go between now and January. And hopefully you have all the answers, and hopefully it looks like a smooth transition, and hopefully it's workable. If not, then the hard answers the advisory committee didn't have the luxury of doing last time, you're going to see at this podium. Thanks.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. You have stressed the importance of a single point of accountability. This plan, though, illustrates that DCBS wouldn't be doing everything. DCBS would actually contract with one or more agencies to do certain things to help accomplish everything that needs to be done. DCBS has a pretty good track record. People are a little nervous about, okay, who's going to do this now, and are they going to do it well? But if DCBS is then potentially contracting with other agencies or departments or sections to do certain things, you're only as good as the people you then rely on. What is DCBS's ability to manage that and to get other people to shape up if something starts going south?
Sure. Co-chairs, Representative Nathanson, thanks for the question. the list of nervous people, believe me, include me, as we think about this. We have a track record over many years dealing with multiple agencies and dealing with intergovernmental agreements, dealing with things like complex data transfer, shared responsibility under grants, those kinds of things. And so I'm comfortable, A, in our ability to write good agreements that have metrics and performance standards and those kinds of things so that we have clear understanding about what's supposed to happen. And then, B, I'm very comfortable in our willingness to have hard conversations if hard conversations need to be had about contracts not being performed against, contracts, IGAs, whatever the exact term of art is. That includes and historically has included being willing to say, well, gee, we're not going to pay this invoice until, you know, X, Y, and Z happen or those sorts of things. The point, though, from my standpoint for you is that the single point of accountability means you don't need to care about what agency X or entity Y is doing. You get to hold me accountable, whether it was because I didn't do it myself or I couldn't get somebody else to do it for me. You got one place to go to be able to say why isn't this happening or make it happen or those kinds of things. And so it's the one piece of a point of accountability applies no matter how many points the functions are being delivered.
A brief follow-up. I just hope it doesn't get to that point. I hope that we're developing a structure and using a process where you have the tools you need to keep it from getting to the point where we need to exercise that.
I agree. Option.
Thank you very much. We will be hearing from you next month.
Thank you.
All right. We have Jessica Adams. We have some invited testimony. Jessica Adamson, Jeremy Vandehey, Mike Dewey, and Tom Holt. I know there are only three chairs, but why don't you all come?
Do your best.
And keep it brief.
We have, 2 minutes apiece, max.
No problem.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Mountis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We thank you for the invitation to share our perspective on this important issue. We have three brief comments to make. First, the timeliness and the smoothness of this transition is critical. Our business operations and the things that need to happen between today and October 2015 will go by in a blink. 10 months is a very short period of time to be ready for another open enrollment, even though we're under open enrollment today, making sure that whoever has accountability for these functions is not just operationally accountable, but they're up and functioning in a full and complete manner is really critical. Second, we'd like to say that we really appreciate the draft description of how Director Allen would intend to incorporate these functions into DCBS. We agree that they need to be a separate unit, that they need to be independent of the Oregon Insurance Division. We have a great relationship with the Insurance Division, but they are our regulator. And that's a very different function than the relationship that we have with Cover Oregon today. We would respectfully request that the draft be amended to make it clear that they are two different functions and that these functions need to be in a separate unit. We realize that would be different than how these units are handled today, but we believe that that's an important enough component operationally and really how we deal with those agencies that it really needs to be something that's in statute so that if that were to change in the future, that would be a decision that the legislature would make after making sure that there was input from stakeholders and really a deliberative decision. So we believe that's important. Last but not least, we fully support a clean bill that simply makes the transfer and doesn't reopen significant policy conversations that were had in 2011 and 2012. Those were long and important conversations. To the extent that those conversations need to be had or not, again, we think that there is another time, another place to do that. The importance of moving this bill smoothly and in a timely fashion, we believe necessitates avoiding those conversations and simply making the transfer as cleanly as possible. Thank you.
Jeremy.
Chair Greenlee, Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Jeremy Vande and Biafa Kaiser Permanente. So I would echo many of the comments that Jessica just had and many of the comments from earlier in the hearing. Kaiser's been very supportive of a robust exchange, both for individual and small group, and we're excited to have that and have eventually have a shop up. We haven't to date taken a position on where exactly all the pieces land, but we're comfortable with the direction of this LLC to move things over to DCBS, and we think that makes a lot of sense. Would echo the sentiment that we appreciate the direction that this be really focused on transitioning the operational issues over and not reopening policy. I think that will drag this conversation out. We've had a lot of conversations already, and I think one of the important components of this is that this happened as quick as possible. There needs to be a long, smooth transition, but there also the transition also needs to occur sooner rather than later. And so, the extent we can have a non-controversial bill that's focused on just transitioning the operational issues and get to work on that as soon as possible, that would be great. We've noticed some drafting questions, and I'll submit those in writing to just for purposes of time. But a couple issues I did just want to put on the record. One, as I mentioned, we're very supportive of a small group exchange. We're excited to have the day when that's up and running and in full force. One of the value adds that we've really thought a small group exchange will have is the opportunity for employee choice. And so while this bill doesn't specifically focus on that, I just wanted to put that on the record, and we hope that we don't miss the opportunity to be able to have that a full shop with employee choice in the future. Just a couple comments on the assessment. We're generally comfortable with, you know, keeping the assessment in the current framework and statute. But two points I just wanted to raise. One is that if we're going to be using the federal exchange, there's a federal assessment as well. We want to make sure we aren't paying a double assessment, a state assessment plus a federal assessment. Whatever costs are associated with using the federal exchange, we think that should come out of the DCBS budget and the assessment that comes from carriers for that. And related, we want to make sure that I'd happen to notice in the LLC, it looks like the revenue from the state assessment would just be deposited into the single DCBS general fund. I think it would be appropriate to probably call out a separate and distinct fund specifically for those exchange assessments, so it's very easy to track where the money is going, make sure it doesn't get commingled, and we've got a really clear, transparent eye on what's going on with the expenses within the new exchange.
Mike Dewey.
Thank you. For the record, Mike Dewey for Moda Health. Fawn Berry is our resident expert in the building. She is on her way to Hawaii, and she would not change her ticket for tomorrow. So I'm here. She would be more precise and interesting than I am. We're still looking at the bill. We do appreciate the speaker and their staff and the Senate president and the staff giving us a heads up on the legislation, what they want to do, and that was a discussion we had on Friday, so we really appreciate that. So we're going to be looking at it still from the technical side of it. We have great respect, and I've worked with Pat Allen over the years in various capacities, and he runs a very good regulatory agency. And if anything in terms of the advisory committee is similar to MLAC, that would be a good result in terms of the coordination and the communication. In terms of just the division of the insurance commissioner and authorities, we're still working through this and this Chinese firewall. I want to use a kind of a legal term here in terms of what you can share and so forth. But we're still working through exactly how that might work. We do have a concern about duplication with CMS in the sense that there may be duplication with regard to networks in terms of adequacy, rates, and the like. And we don't want the premium to get too excessive because we do have – CMS has significant responsibility and can basically overturn what we want to do at the end of the game. So that's very important to us in terms of the duplication. The cost of, and Jeremy talked about this, we would like to be sure that, and there's like a six-month reserve in here, as I recall. We just don't want to have any of this money be raided, and that happens from time to time, and if there's a way to ensure that, because I think we've all been surprised in fiscal crises that has happened, and that's a way to balance the budget, but nonetheless, if there's something we can do there. Then we are very favorable toward the subsidies and would want those to continue. That is why the Affordable Care Act, for in terms of how you look at it from our standpoint, we have the largest share of the market, at least today. The subsidies are, to a large degree, what drives this. So because of the court challenge at the Supreme Court, you need to write it in such a way that if the Supreme Court overturns some of the subsidies, I have no clue what they're going to do, that the Oregon Exchange is going to be able to provide still, through the federal government, those subsidies to keep the plan in place. And afterwards, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We very much appreciate the opportunity. And we will come back as we look at this bill and as you have amendments. And we'd be happy to meet individually with any of you to talk further about our view of the world, at least today.
Thank you. Tom Holt.
For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions, co-chair Greenlick, co-chair Monos Anderson, members of the committee. I concur with all the comments that you've already heard. I just want to highlight a few things. One, we think this is really the right direction of focusing on this really being an operations kind of question of how do we just move what's left of the exchange into DCBS. So directionally, it's a very good draft. Lori's done good work on a short timeline, but like others, we are still going through the technical language, and I expect that we'll have some comments, and I think we're probably all going to work together to try at least administratively make that easier to process and getting in one spot. I'd like to underscore this notion of the calling out the separation between the exchange function and the regulatory function of the insurance division, both practically and from a consumer appearance point of view. We think it's going to be important to do that in the bill so that we don't have even the appearance of sort of the regulator in business with the regulated. As the exchange is really an effort besides the technical work. It's promoting the idea of buying our products through exchanges. At the same time, we have a good regulator who's watching over that, and important to have a separation of those things that's very clear. We have great confidence in Mr. Allen and his leadership, and we have a good relationship with the insurance division, but this is a long-term project, and 10, 20 years from now, we want to make sure that it's working the way that we start out. Second issue is around the assessments. These are baked into the premiums that people pay, and they're paying those assessments for the operations of the exchange. So our view would be that very much like the high-risk pool program that the state operated for the last 20 years and just recently wrapped up, there was a separate account for keeping track of the funds there. And over time, if there were either not enough assessment or too much assessment collected, then adjustments could be made because we could track those dollars. And we would suggest something similar here. And that was a program that operated within a much larger agency. So we would suggest that approach as well. And then last, just a bit about timeline. Can't underscore enough the operational urgency here to do this smoothly. I'm sure Mr. Allen has already thought about what people, what talents he's going to need in-house. I think Co-Chair Greenlick, you're right to give, we need to give some thought about making sure we don't put triggers into the bill that are going to cause Pat to be without people that he needs during the transition. But to give you an idea where we are in looking at, the 2016 plan year, which is the next thing affected by all of this, right here in December, our product people and our actuaries are already doing well into their work for 2016 plans. We will file plans for approval in the spring. We will file rates on those plans in the late spring. Approvals for those things will come late spring and into summer. By the time we get toward the end of session, everything's going to be pretty well baked, and it's a matter of operationalizing that with getting things submitted technically to the federal government for people to be able to buy these things through the exchange. So there's a lot of work that has to be done, and we just can't afford to have any hiccups. So I guess our urgency would be, let's, while we want to be careful about setting up the structure and the new structure within DCBS and do it in a way that's going to be sustainable over the very long term, we should not take too much time in getting this done, because if we get into springtime and there's key decisions not yet made, that has an impact on our ability to execute and do things well so the consumers have a good experience next fall with their next open enrollment. And then I guess I lied, one last thing, that is do everything you can to preserve the eligibility for subsidies. That's on all of our minds. So with that, be happy to take questions, but we welcome this opportunity.
I think in deference to time, we're going to move on. We will have much more public testimony, et cetera, next time. All ideas, amendments need
to,
yes, need to go through Sandy or Anna in the president's office if you have ideas or changes that you want done. Jesse O'Brien and Andrea Salinas.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer group. In the interest of time, I will be as brief as I can. I know we're already getting over the original time. For just a little bit of background, OSPIRG has been involved in the conversation about the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange for many years, and I've had the pleasure to serve on the Cover Oregon Community Consumer Advisory Committee since 2012. And OSPIRG has been a big supporter of a strong health insurance exchange for Oregon because, if done right, we believe that a health insurance exchange could be one of the most important tools for consumers to get a better deal on health insurance and to make healthcare work better for Oregon. I think it's uncontroversial to say that we're not there yet, but we have, as has been mentioned earlier today, made a huge amount of progress in covering Oregonians with health insurance and the Oregon Health Plan, and I think that shouldn't get lost in this conversation. We have come a long way in the last year. We are happy to work with you, with DCBS, with Cover Oregon to ensure a transition that delivers a health insurance marketplace that works for Oregon consumers. And I can say that we're generally comfortable with the approach outlined in the LC, although we have a lot of questions and ideas that we'll share with you in writing and in future public comments. Just very briefly, though, we do think that it's important that the transition makes sure that the health insurance exchange has the tools it needs to, first of all, leverage the buying power of Oregonians by pushing for quality and value and having high standards for participating plans. That is a set of authorities that Cover Oregon has in various forms right now. We want to make sure that those are preserved and that there's some opportunity for consumer input into how those standards are developed. We also think, of course, I don't think anyone will dispute this, that it's vitally important that Oregon find a path forward to create a SHOP, a small business health options program that works. We don't want our small businesses in this small business state to be left behind. We also think, as has been extensively discussed, that transparency and accountability in governance is absolutely crucial. I have a lot of questions about how the advisory committee outlined in the LC is going to work. We can go over that at a later time. But I do think it's very important to make sure that there's a voice in that advisory committee and in the governance of the exchange for consumers and small businesses and enrollment assisters, the organizations doing the hard work of assisting assisting people with getting coverage day-to-day on the ground. And part of the reason why this is important is that I think it's really important for a health insurance exchange program to have feedback loops with the people on the ground signing up for coverage and doing the work of helping those folks sign up for coverage so that it can catch and resolve problems quickly. Like I said, we do have some specific ideas and suggestions, but those can wait until future meetings, and we can submit some ideas in writing, but we look forward to participating in this conversation going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea.
For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I am the contract lobbyist for the Service Employees International Union, Local 503, OPEU. Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you. I do not want to play cleanup, but I will do this as quickly as possible. On behalf of the 20,000 SEIU members potentially eligible for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, SEIU commends you on all of this great work that you've done to date and moving forward. We know it is not an easy task, and we want to thank you for the hundreds of thousands of uninsured that previously did not have health insurance, many of whom are SEIU members. SEIU never supported a public corporation governance structure under the authorizing statute that created the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. So I'm sure it comes as no surprise that we are very pleased to see it being moved to an agency, and DCBS works for us. We believe that this state agency will provide the legislature with the needed oversight to efficiently manage Oregon's health insurance exchange. While Cover Oregon's first year of enrollment saw a number of problems, SEIU's workers saw many benefits of having health insurance, and some for the first time in over a decade. Many of our workers still struggle to find affordable quality health insurance, even under the silver medal tier plan, even with federal subsidies, due to high cost share and copays. So with that, we would urge the committee moving forward to ensure, as Jesse mentioned, that every tool is made available to DCBS, as it is to Cover Oregon right now, to ensure the highest quality, most affordable health insurance plans in the exchange as we transition, and that this is not lost. DCBS, we believe, can develop a really competitive marketplace for the exchange. We would also want the committee to ensure that the mistakes that were made by Cover Oregon, like those of the advanced premium tax credit, are transitioned smoothly and consumers know how to access current and any legacy information. We also want to ensure that the current enrollment process, life qualifying events, and the transition of enrollment is made as smooth as possible, enabling those who qualify for health insurance to access it, void of any political manipulation. Thank you for your time and remaining vigilant to the concerns of the hardworking Oregonians who need health care in order to remain an integral part of our state's workforce. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do want to reiterate changes that you want, submit them as soon as you can to Sandy or to Anna in the president's office. Okay. Thank you very much. And I would like to call Aaron Patnoid back up. There's a I think he wants to clarify something that he said, and also there is a question that Dr. Bates would like
sure.
to ask you also.
So thank you for the opportunity to come back up. My apologies, but in my haste to respond to Representative Davis's question regarding the run rate, I wanted to make sure I got the data correct. So, excuse me. Oh, sorry. For the record, my name is Aaron Patnoid. I'm Executive Director of Cover Oregon. My apologies. So the run rate in regards to Cover Oregon, it's an interesting story to tell. So to date, through October, I should say, we've spent $74 million. So averaging that out simply, you can arrive at $7.4 million per month. However, the run rate for the first half of 2014 was dramatically different than the second half of 2014 thus far. So for the 4 months leading into and including October, we've spent $3 million when $4 million had been budgeted for those months. So we were $1 million under budget for those 4 months, including October. So this is contributing to that contingency. So my apologies for misspeaking on that. I felt, given the opportunity to be on the record, that getting the correct information to the committee would be important. So thank you, and my apologies.
Senator Bates.
Just real quick. This morning, I had one of my staffers go online to sign up. And, the damn thing actually works. You know, it's kind of amazing, okay? But the real question is, while my staffer could have signed up, nobody seems to be signing up in significant numbers right now. We're going to have a gap in January if people don't sign up by the next 4 or 5 days. And that's going to affect the assessment, because assessment based on numbers. assessment's going to go up per person on their premiums, will make premiums harder to sell. Does anybody have any idea why people are putting off signing up? Is it, I mean, if the system's working, are people just procrastinating? Are people unaware that in January they don't have coverage and they can't get it until February? They're going to have a month of open coverage here. I mean, what do you think is going on? Does anybody else have any idea what's going on?
Sure. So co-chairs Montez Anderson, co-chair Greenlick, Senator Bates, one of the important lessons that we learned, or one of the findings we had from the 2014 experience, was that people will wait to the absolute last minute to sign up. So while we do have some data from a call that the OID has made to the carriers, I think what Cover Oregon is committed to doing right now is continuing to get the message out in relation to the important deadlines that people need to know in order to enroll. We'll continue to work with our federal partners at healthcare.gov to get the best information we can from their enrollment and eligibility system.
Madam Chair, yes. If I may, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I had a conversation with Mr. Colmer from the governor's office about this very issue not an hour before this committee started. He said a couple of things that I thought were helpful. The first is that for PEB beneficiaries, which many of us are, 60-70% of the enrollment happens in the last 72 hours before the deadline, because most of us, yours truly included, are not great at doing this kind of stuff until the last minute. It's a little less complicated to sign up for PEB than it is for through the exchange, but I think we're going to see the same thing. He believes that the federal government's helpline is staffed up and ready to deal with the fact that the deadline is on a Monday evening and the last 72 hours includes a weekend. So that's part one. Part two is that people can continue to enroll after the deadline. They just can't be guaranteed coverage by January 1st, and they can't be guaranteed the tax credit. So they can enroll with the understanding that they would have to pay the entire premium and then cancel that version and use the version that they've signed up on through via the exchange and start getting the tax credit in February. So I am not at all convinced, I don't think anybody believes, that we will get 100% enrollment by December 15th of everybody who's eligible and should have signed up by December 15th, even among those who already have insurance through the exchange. I do think that there will be opportunities, although not as good, to continue to reach out. And Mr. Patnaud, please correct me if I'm wrong, after the December 15th deadline, to continue to identify and encourage those who have not yet signed up and would be eligible.
Okay. And brief?
Very brief. Will you have the answer, some answer to Doc's question in January when we come here?
Regarding the assessment fee?
Regarding the number of people that we think have signed up by then.
So, co-chairs, members of the committee, my hope is yes. The data call that the OID is asking carriers for takes place on a weekly basis. So we will get ongoing data from our market. I will continue to pursue the information directly from healthcare.gov. My hope is that getting it directly from the eligibility and enrollment system will be the best source of data for us. But at this point in time, relying on our carrier partners and our partners in the Oregon Insurance Division is the best for us right now. So,
yes.
All right. Thank you. All right. Well, our next meeting will be January 9th from 10 to 1. That is before organizational days. That's a Friday. Co-chair, do you have any?
Thank you very much for all your testimony today. It's been very helpful.
All right. We're adjourned. Okay.
Is it time? Okay. Is it time?